Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Tim Moen Show. We got a special treat for you today. You may remember back in December, I had a debate conversation, if you will, a three-part conversation with communist Billy Bob. Since that debate, Billy Bob has gone on to debate another libertarian, one you might well know, Manuel. Actually, Manuel has made me a relatively rich man. He's given me a little bit of Bitcoin over the years. That $200 in Bitcoin that it's accumulated over the years, I just cashed in for over $2,000. I'm buying a laptop, baby. We're upgrading this podcast. Thanks to Manuel. That Manuel and Billy Bob have reached out to me, and they want to have a group conversation. Billy Bob's bringing a friend. I'm bringing Manuel. And so we're going to have libertarians versus communists. But there's a twist. I didn't want to just do a regular old debate. I kind of find them boring, and they've all been done before. We've all got our talking points and paraphrases, and it kind of becomes formulaic. I don't get the sense that people are really trying to understand the other position when they're having these conversations. I wanted to do something a little different, a little bit more productive. So we're doing an experiment today. We're doing what I am billing a steel man debate, in which we argue for the side we're against. And so Manuel and I, as anarcho-capitalist libertarians, are going to be arguing, trying to make the best case possible we can for communism. And Billy Bob and Chris, the two communists, are going to be making the best case they can for libertarianism. At the end, our goal is to critique each other and tell the other side how well they're making an argument for our side. So I want to be really good at making the case for communism. I really want to understand the case for communism. And if it's right, maybe accept it. And if it's not right, I want to be able to eviscerate it in the most strong manner possible. And you can only do that by creating a steel man version of that argument, not a straw man, which is typically what happens on Facebook and other social media pages. So guys, please welcome our guests here. We got Manuel, Billy Bob, and Chris. Guys, thank you for joining this experiment and this.
Thank you, Tim, for having us.
Yeah, so we've got people from all over the map here. Manuel's out in Eastern Canada. Billy Bob's in Western U.S. Chris is in the Philippines, right? And yep. I'm in Alberta. And so we're not just politically diverse; we are geographically diverse as well. All right, how do we want to do this, guys? Who wants to go first? Should we go back and forth?
Maybe I don't... we should start with like pros. Like we have a pro sales pitch first.
Right, because... right. Yeah, and I think in the interest of time, we may just limit this to pros. Like just we'll make the pro communism pitch. You will make the pro-libertarianism pitch. We'll kind of talk about how well we did in making the pitch. You guys will tell us how well we did at pitching communism. We'll tell you how well you did at pitching libertarianism. And then we'll, you know, if we have time, we can then get into like a real debate. But I really don't want to, I think it'll be productive if we end this with Manuel and I really understanding your position and you guys really understanding our position. That's the goal here. And then we could, that could launch into further conversations once we really understand where we disagree. Cause I get the sense that a lot of times when we're arguing, we don't really have a good understanding on what we disagree on. Like I'm trying to really hard to figure that out. Right. So I think this kind of conversation might help us get there. Any thoughts from you guys?
Well, if we cooperate and like work together in a business kind of perspective, there's that. I mean, Bitcoin's at what, 72K right now?
Something like that, yeah.
So maybe any dividends that come out of this? How much?
So I forgot. Manuel offered me Bitcoin too, and I never did what he told me. I needed to purchase a wallet, and I never did. Oh, so
you need to purchase it. It's free.
Yeah, okay. I need to download. I need to do the technical aspects, and then I got some Bitcoin coming my way. But I don't mind starting. I can go ahead and just do my best to, you know, explain why libertarianism is the way to go. Yeah. And I won't even get into why communism sucks so bad. Like, get into why you two ignorant communists are dumb, you know?
All right.
What do you got there? Newport?
Yep, Newport double black. Smells delicious.
Are you? I think he's getting product placement. So the revolution, okay. So you know, I'll go ahead and give my idea of, and again, it's kind of extemporaneous. I didn't do much preparation either. But I mean, essentially, libertarianism is about liberty, right? It's promoting liberty. And it's the idea that everybody has a right to the liberty in their person, you know, and their property. And that nobody else has a right to tell them, you know, tell them what to do. So, and that includes the government. So essentially, it just, it's a philosophy that promotes individual liberty in your person and your property. And politically, it manifests itself in, you know, the smallest kind of government possible, right? We don't want government encroaching on our freedoms, on our projects, and things like that. So if you embrace the idea of freedom, and you don't want to be told what to do, you know, by a government or somebody that thinks they know better for you than you know for yourself, libertarianism is for you. That's essentially what libertarianism is. There's many kinds of libertarianism, anarcho-libertarianism, socialist libertarianism. But essentially, it's the idea that, you know, nobody has the right to dictate to us what we do with our body or our property.
Taxes, like. We haven't paid taxes here, nothing.
Amen, brother.
Well, taxes, it's an additional issue. You know, different libertarians have different perspectives on taxes. You know, some libertarians believe taxes are theft. Other libertarians are minarchists. You know, they want the smallest state possible, but they understand that taxes might be necessary for, you know, defense, the military, police, upholding the law, etc. But again, as small of a government as is possible is the ideal. But Chris, you take it from here. Go, Chris.
Can we maybe go back and forth? I'll maybe respond, you know, because my comrade there, Billy Bob, has basically made my argument for communism for me. He said it right there. No one should be able to tell me what to do. Well, old Billy Bob there supports a system that exploits me, that has a boss telling me what to do every day, day in, day out. It's an exploitative system where I work to create surplus value. I create more than I consume. And the boss takes all that extra value I produce. And while I'm out there grinding away on the factory floor, he's sitting on piles of cash and all sorts of luxury goods. What happens if he introduces technology on the factory floor that, say, doubles production? Does he say, oh, we'll continue paying you the same since we're profiting the same and give you half a day off so you can have more time to devote to, you could make your life better? No, no. What the boss does is fires half the staff, throws them into poverty, and makes me work the same amount of hours for the same pay, even though he's making now hordes of money. And this system... in this system, capital accumulates in accrues in the hands of a few, fewer and fewer hands. So you end up with an oligopoly or a monopoly system, systems that, by the way, libertarians say they're against, but yet they seem to support the very structure that promotes this stuff. You have a system of usury, you know, and a lot of libertarians will claim that their philosophy comes from Christianity, the idea of the sacrosanct spirit of the individual. It's all about worshiping the individual. Well, their Bible that led to that is against usury. Every major religion is against usury. And yet here we have a system, a capitalist system that exploits people, charges them interest on loans, and accumulates more and more wealth in the hands of the few. It does this through a number of mechanisms, but basically it grapples with, it possesses the state and uses the power of the state to crush competitors and through things like intellectual property. Imagine having an idea owned as property that no one else can use that idea. I can't create the same pattern as you. This is capitalism. Well, what we propose as communists is much more humane, much more just. And that is simply direct democracy in the workplace. We should share the fruits of our labor. We should, as a collective, determine how things get produced, how our lives are managed, and so forth. And that I will cede my time now to the selfish libertarian known as Chris.
Hey, it's not about selfish. It's about making business, making industry. We're entrepreneurs over here. And that's what needs to be embraced in modern culture, because there's not enough individuals sticking up, using their own capital, and gaining capital, using modern technology, you know, like Bitcoin's at 72K right now. You can sell it, buy a truck. What can you do with a truck? You know what I mean? You can hire a bunch of guys, get a bunch of work done, get some money. It's all small business. And we don't got to tell nobody nothing, no taxes. So why the big picture?
Okay.
Okay.
That's good. That's classic libertarian.
Top of the morning to you, my lady.
All right, comrade. Put the final nail in the coffin of these libertarian heathens.
My turn?
Yeah, it's your turn.
Okay.
We're sharing here, Manuel. We're not monopolizing the time.
Manuel's probably the only one that prepared. He's going to make us all look bad.
All right.
I appreciate what Tim said in defense of socialism. But fundamentally, the problem with capitalism is that capitalism, at the point it has reached today, no longer develop the productive force, no longer answers to human needs. Capitalism has attained a point where it only benefits to enrich a tiny percentage of the population, which is like 0.001%. It doesn't suit human needs, but that's not the worst of all. Capitalism, since 1914, has stopped having any progressive aspect it has, because even Marx recognized that capitalism had progressive aspect compared to feudalism that was before. Capitalism raised the productivity, developed the productive force. Unfortunately, in the beginning of the 20th century, capitalism entered a phase when it became, it was no longer the free market. It was monopolistic. It was financial. And the worst of all, it became imperialistic. As people like Lenin, one of the great thinkers of this world, prove in his book, unfortunately, I don't have the book. He wrote a book, Imperialism, The Supreme State of Capitalism, and he explained fully why capitalism caused wars. And so in the 20th century, we got the First World War, the Second World War, that were imperialist war caused by capitalism. And today, we're on
government. Government, Manuel. Sorry.
It is the state. Yeah. It is the state.
Well, who do you think runs the state, libtards?
And now, 2024, we are on the verge of a third world war, which could possibly wipe out humanity because of all the nuclear weapons that humankind have. So capitalism now just is a system that needs to be abolished because it just threatened the survival of mankind. So.
Okay. Capitalism is just freedom. You're talking about authority. You're talking about cronyism. It's different. Cronyism. So, okay.
Well, look, what do you expect to happen, though? I mean, yes, of course cronyism is going to happen. This is why we need the state to own the means of production, or at least control it or highly regulate it.
I mean, I never paid for any of that out of my own volition. Like, that's taxes. And if taxes weren't here, none of that would happen.
Well, the corporation would just become the government, wouldn't it? It would run us.
Who's paying them?
I'm not gonna buy their products. They're gonna go out of business.
Tim, I'm having a hard time arguing with you. I don't know what's going on. You guys are pretty good at this. All right. Well, let's put a pin in it for a second and see where this goes. Okay. Let's talk about how we did here. Billy Bob, what do you think about Manuel and my arguments for communism? What did we get right? What did we get wrong?
What really struck me the most, and I mean, I'm serious here, is that, after I gave my spiel on liberty, you guys didn't even address what I was saying. Like, so you were arguing against something I'm not arguing for. So that was my first and biggest thing was, you guys are responding to my talk about liberty and individual freedom. Okay. And you're totally not even addressing anything I said, and you're arguing against something that I also oppose.
Gotcha. Which, okay.
And that epiphany makes me realize that we're not too far apart.
Billy Bob, you're against war.
So you guys like to put me down on these principles, and I don't believe in eternal principles, right? I believe in material conditions, and given the existing material conditions, what do we do? I think war is sometimes necessary. War is sometimes good, but it's, you know, it depends on the existing material conditions within which we find ourselves to decide, is war good? Is war not good? Is taxes good? Is taxes not good? And so, Manuel, I'm sorry, but generally speaking, yeah, I oppose war. Peace is good. Peace, mutual prosperity, those things are good. But again, I got to understand that at certain times, you know, war is going to be necessary, depending on the circumstances.
Sorry,
that's for sure.
I'm a little confused. I'm just okay. Just so we understand, we're back to being who we are. We're libertarians, you're communists,
okay,
all right?
Okay.
Now, what I want to know,
there, like,
yeah, me too. I was like, is he arguing as a libertarian or as Billy Bob? I'm not sure who he is right now. I feel like I'm schizo.
No, I was going to ask him.
Billy Bob, but before we get into your question, I know Manuel has some questions. We'll probably pick each other's brain about each other's ideology here. I just want to know from you guys, did Manuel and I make a reasonable case for communism? Or was there something missing? Was there something you would have added? Did we get something wrong?
And Manuel had the citations. That was amazing. And communists love citations. Like, super good. That was a great performance.
Look, I probably read at least 10, if not 20 books written by Marx, Lenin, Trotsky, and Rosa Luxemburg. And now I have this book I have to read. Because look, I'm friend with oh, you have it too.
It just came in the mail.
Our common friend Jacques Powells, who is a Marxist and not a Trotskyite, because I used to be a Trotskyist. Jacques is believe that Stalin was a good guy. And because I respect Jacques for the books he wrote against war, and that I debated a little bit with him on Stalin, and he invited me to read that book. And I said, okay, I have to be honest, I'm going to read the book. I sent him a book, written an entire war book written by a libertarian. So I said, to be honest, I'm going to read the book. And I already understand one of the case in favor of Stalin is that if he didn't had industrialized the Soviet Union the way he did in the 1930s, which was brutal, which killed a lot of people, Nazi Germany would have totally, they were done. And if
they
it was
been speaking German, yeah.
But no, but the Western imperialism, and not just Nazi Germany, because Nazi Germany, Nazism is nothing. Nazism represents German imperialism. Like
Africa at the time. So.
Yeah, like Churchill and Roosevelt represented U.S. and British imperialism. Hitler is not, it's not worse than those guys for me. So the Soviet Union was a target of Western imperialism. If it would not have been Germany, it could have been Germany allied with Britain and the U.S. against them. So Stalin, I understand the argument that Stalin did had to industrialize his country, otherwise Western imperialism would have crushed him. So,
and I apologize for breaking.
I don't agree with the what he did. Let's be clear. Don't agree with that. I know that Trotsky preferred the solution that the working class of the Western countries would make a revolution to destroy imperialism in those countries. Me, I think. If I had to be a Marxist, I would prefer that solution. But no, when we were role playing, when we were role playing, when I asked you if you were in favor of war,
yeah.
What I wanted to say is that a lot of libertarians are hypocrites, and they support war. Even my friend Tim, that I love very much. I find him to be weak on criticizing war and the military. And it's nothing compared to a lot of other libertarians, and Tim knows about.
No. Us libertarians are very specific. Taxes fund warfare. And we don't want any taxes. No more taxes, no warfare. Very simple equation.
Yeah, there's different kinds of libertarians. But I really thought we had stopped being in character. Because I was giving my thought on how it went, but my apologies. I can try and stay in character.
Okay. It's okay. It's just that I wanted to make fun of the fact that there are a lot of libertarians are hypocrites, and even in the group where for the Libertarian Party of Canada, a lot of people hate me. Because I'm against war, because I don't consider that their grandfather fought for freedom in 1939. I said they were cannon fodder for imperialism. Those people hate me. I received hate message from those people.
Fair enough. Okay, so how did we do on making the argument for communism?
Chris, what do you think?
And Tim, the argument for communism was really like grandiose, but it didn't have like all the backing. I feel like as a socialist, you have to like build things on the material kind of like path to things. So there's more of like a grandiose idea rather than a way of historical precedence for different events.
Okay, right. So you, I noticed that there's a lot of, a lot of it is reading of history, right? Like is there principles in communism, or is it just kind of loosey goosey, whatever you're feeling, based on your reading of history or something? I don't understand. Like, what lens do you look at history through?
It's about, I think if I could answer, it's about the concept of private property. And that the labor theory of value, and one of the principles of communism that I understand that I reject is that for each according to his need,
from like, according to his ability.
Yeah, you will receive what you need. You will produce what you can. I understand that kind of principle. Me, I disagree with that because it means that a person that would be very innovative, productive, can receive less than somebody who doesn't work because he's sick. And let's be clear, I agree that we should help people.
Manuel, it sounds like you're debating communism right now. What I'm trying to do is understand whether our argument was a good steel man or not. So I'm hearing from Chris that I didn't build up in my case from a materialist perspective. I just want to understand that a little bit better.
That's a good question for like us Marxists. And we have like four steps of human progress of like primitive communism where money wasn't a thing, you know, like at we're tribal, that sort of thing. That period of human era through the ages, it morphed into feudalistic sort of terms. So,
on a step towards something else like communism or something, right?
Between feudalism, mercantilism, capitalism will evolve into a different form of socialism, and communism is a very far way off.
Because, is that the final state, or is there something beyond communism?
Right. Well, we wouldn't know that because it's not in our perspective.
Gotcha. Okay. And is it just a prediction, like that this is what it's going to naturally occur, or is it something to be sought after and to be pushed for?
Well, it's the means of production are real central to this because when there's enough of a production that, I mean, from what I was saying, like in the libertarian kind of sense, when I was role-playing, is that you're like building a company, but those industries consolidate. So when those industries get too large and they consolidate, if you don't nationalize it into something that's going to benefit everybody, it's just going to stay in like one familial order. Or American capitalism kind of breaks it into like stock brokership rather than family organized things. And that's something I sort of realized when I moved to the old world from.
Okay. So is it kind of, I'm still trying to understand. Is it that you predict that just kind of naturally, kind of organically, this order will fall away and give way to communism? Maybe we get to something like post-scarcity, or is it something that has to be smashed? Does there have to be a revolution in order to get to that thing?
And that depends on the context of the place.
Okay. So what would, I guess, make you decide one way or the other?
Like here in the Philippines, there is a civil war going on between capitalists, communists, and sometimes the Islamic South. It's a very messy, like, political arena. But what would make it is just that the abuse that happens from certain, like, you know, like plantation owners or something like that is just too much for people to take, then revolution would be necessary.
Okay.
But if it's benefiting everybody, like if it's bringing in a lot of stuff, like people aren't going to want to change that, you know?
Yeah. Well, that was the point I was going to make. Historically, you know, the revolutions occurred where people had nothing to lose and they had no other option.
Exactly. So
that's when revolution, but the foundation that what communism is grounded on is the inescapable fact, and I pulled up a quote from Frederick Engels kind of describing it, but I can try and say it in my own terms. You know, every society is dependent on things that it produces, right?
Right.
So societies can't exist without production. And right. So production is necessary, and how we organize that production is not set in stone. There's different relationships. There's different ways to organize that production. Capitalism is a particular mode of production that private individuals produce things for profit. And I mean, that's a mode of, that's what capitalism is. So communists say that because of that mode of production, it divides society between two kinds of individuals: owners, private owners of the means of production, and workers. So workers are always going to be the vast majority, and the owners are always going to be a wealthy elite. And that division is fundamental in understanding reality, understanding historic reality. So we look at reality through the lens of class struggle.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I get it. So this is what you're against, but I'm trying to get at what you're for, what you're in favor of. How are, what does that reorganization look like?
Well,
and so like what guides that reorganization?
Instead of producing things for profit, we would be producing things based on need, you know? And so we wouldn't have a whole bunch of empty houses that are, you know, when we have homeless people, you know, these are contradictions within capitalism, within this capitalist mode of production. So we're for more addressing the needs of the people. So fundamentally though, what the difference is that the government, who is in charge of the society? I don't think really a democracy right. exists. I think we have two options. Given under capitalism, there's only two options. It's sure. the dictatorship of the working class or the dictatorship of the ownership class. And I think what the West is, it's a very, you know, it's kind of a when you hide something. So, you know, it's they put on this mask of liberalism, but in reality, it's a dictatorship, and it's hidden behind this facade of liberalism yeah. and democracy.
Well, but I don't think you get an argument from us on that necessarily.
What we advocate for is the replacement of the dictatorship of the wealthy elites with a working class government, and that's all it is. And I think there is room for agreement with that.
I mean, I guess a fairly, it's not real clear to me exactly what that is or what that looks like. I guess the devil would be in the details, right?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, sure. But
you're talking about a 5-year plan.
What's that? Well, no, I'm just talking about what does that structure look like even, right? Cause I could argue that a complete free market is exactly that, a democracy of the people, of the workers. Because it's people yeah. who have homesteaded and appropriated their material in nature and are using that and deploying it in a way that expresses their values. And that would probably be the most pure form of democracy. And it's by the people actually doing work and producing value, right? And not some statist fucks or something like that.
That's an interesting perspective there, in my opinion, because I mean that's very frontiersy. There's population density per area. I mean that certainly would work, encouraging the individualism, and it should happen for outdoorsmen, frontiersmen, like that sort of thing. Yeah. Like in Vietnam, China, Korea, in the communist countries, they tell you if you want communism, go farming.
Right. Set up a commune, right? I got you. Okay, so you're saying that
it's going to look different in different places. In Alberta, if that's where you're in, you know, that could be what communism looks like. That could be what the people's government looks like. But how do you get to that point? Because you have a ruling elite that is going to kill and die before they allow you any kind of freedom to do that. So, and that's what Lenin right. was talking about. So there's a science. There's a science to recognizing that the bourgeoisie aren't going to allow any changes that benefit the people. And how do we overcome that? How do we get people on the same page? That's the science of, you know, of materialism, of right. Marxist-Leninism.
Gotcha. All right. Okay, yeah. let me... sorry. Go ahead, Manuel. I want to get to critiquing your guys's arguments for libertarianism, but Manuel, go ahead.
There was a case I remember because I made a course on Marx and his successor, Marx, Lenin, Trotsky, and the teacher told us an example that in the 19th century, there was a British capitalist that decided to go to Australia with his workers. And when the workers arrived, they abandoned the guy to go homestead freelance. What did the capitalist did? He went to the state to forbid the worker to homestead lands.
Right.
So yeah, I mean they were a don back then. I mean that's his guys.
Yeah.
I had a conversation with only me and Billy Bob a few months ago, and I told that for me I would say 95% of at least 95% of the billionaire are illegitimate people that owns above $1 billion or even $100 million. For me, they're evil people. They're
hard to earn that much. It's too much.
No, I fully agree. Because
a lot of work, right?
Because it was not made voluntarily. It was made with the coercion of the state. And of course, the state will always be on the side of the rich, the powerful, and the corrupt. So I can agree with a lot of things. Like I said, Marxists, and I think this week's was the anniversary of the death of Karl Marx. And I saw a lot of libertarians that say Karl Marx did something good when he died. And I replied to a few of those guys, sorry, but it's very simplistic. Marx, Lenin, and his Trotsky, Stalin, they may be wrong in their solution, and I fully agree. For me, it's a disaster. But the way they analyze and they explain and they criticize society, there's a lot of good stuff in it. And if libertarians, we don't understand it, we fail because there's a reason why those guys get popular and get follower, because they are right in a lot of way about what they say about the current system. So
yeah.
All right, Manuel, did you have any advice or feedback for these guys about their their presentation of the arguments for libertarianism?
I wish they had mentioned the non-aggression principle and the fact that property right comes from the fact that you own your body and you own the fruits of your labor. And what you own, it's where property rights start. You know, the idea that the King of England owns thousands of square miles of lands, it's not legitimate private property. Even the billions that Elon Musk owned, that comes from the central, because of the central bank inflated the money supply. But private property that comes from your body, the works you do, is legitimate. That's the core of libertarianism. And the non-aggression principle, it's like the reduction of that. It's like simplification of that.
I thought I was kind of basically hitting on that. I didn't use the term nap, but I was thinking about it when I was talking. I did like what Chris said, and it was kind of a slight to the libertarians. But what was the comment? Like, there's no need to look at the big picture or something, Chris?
What were you talking about? Taxes, warfare?
Well, when you were giving your libertarian pitch, you had said something about, you know, why bother looking at the big picture or something. And
why bother looking at the big picture? Like wars and stuff. Like, that's what I was getting at, right?
Hmm. Yeah, that was what. So
yeah, see, that argument wouldn't be very compelling to a libertarian because we see ourselves as seeing the big picture, right? Maybe we don't. You could argue we don't, but we look at things. We're, and this comes right out of Jonathan Haidt's studies on personality and psychological profile of different how it predicts your politics basically, And one of the hallmarks of all libertarian thinking is we're high in systematizing, right? So we're kind of like how Spock would be wired in a lot of ways. You know, some people, we often get fairly accused of essentially being autistic because we're very kind of pedantic about logic and different things like that. And
it's the spectrum.
Yeah. So we look at things from a system. So, you know, we look at wars as bankers' wars, and, you know, we look at the system, and then we break it down to, you know, I try to follow the route down the rabbit hole. I would say the root cause is statism, the use that the idea that we can use violence, violate consent, violate individuals for the greater good, that ultimately leads to these institutions that lead us to all these bad things, monopolies, war, you know, debt, slavery, all the things that we all agree are bad things. You know, we probably just have a different diagnosis on what the cause of that is. You're saying it's capitalism. I think Manuel and I would say it's probably statism. And so our argument, if you really want to eviscerate the libertarian argument, what you have to address is the arguments in that allow the violation of consent, the violation of the individual in the name of the greater good, right? And I'm sure there are arguments that can do that, but those are the arguments that would need to be worked on to kind of penetrate the libertarian brain. And again, it's a highly logical brain. And if you present a highly logical, rational argument, we've changed our minds once before because we were immersed in it. Well, it's Manuel is immersed in a different
what is
paradigm
that
before, right?
But in English.
Sorry, it's state and revolution. Oh,
that's a basic.
But Lenin explained that the state is a tool for class oppression. He's right. It's exactly what it is.
Fair enough.
So, I mean, and I agree with that. And I mean, but I don't, you know, in the group chat that me and Chris are in, you know, I come up against this a lot, and I just don't think it's realistic that we can abolish a state. Because number one, you know, we'd have to overcome the current state, which is the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. And if we did that, you know, we're going to have a reality that isn't going to be able to function, in my opinion, like without some kind of a state apparatus. But, you know, I don't know how to have that discussion. I don't know how to have that discussion.
Well, I mean, that's a discussion.
I know I can call you guys stupid for being stupid.
Yeah.
Well, we just compromise on what a new state should be, right?
Well, I mean, look, I think you're right. I mean, I don't know how you abolish the state. I don't know how you get rid of it. All we can point out is that, look, slavery is immoral. State's immoral. It's one of those institutions that hopefully in 200 years, the arc of the moral universe will bend towards justice and there'll be no more state because enough people will wake up. We got rid of slavery. We got rid of human sacrifice. We got rid of a whole bunch of things over time and we made moral progress. And I think hopefully if we make moral progress by raising our kids right, you know, we might get somewhere. But I don't pretend that I could snap my fingers or that there's any, you know, so to me, it's a matter of maybe it's a matter of having a tipping point of people who refuse to support the aggression of the state over time that causes it to disappear. Maybe it's technologies emerging that make the state irrelevant. You know, I mean, Bitcoin, for example, makes central banking kind of irrelevant. You can imagine.
I mean, the Soviet Union would never have fell if they invented Excel.
If they invented Excel?
But yeah.
Maybe. I mean? An Excel spreadsheet might have kept her going, eh?
I had two questions.
Hey, I could have kept that thing going, probably.
Last time I had...
You need a capitalist to make that shit for you, though, baby.
Last time I had a conversation with Billy Bob, we had to stop because you were going to work. And I had two questions I really wanted you to ask that were still have in my mind. Can I go?
Oh, if it's okay with Tim and Chris.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Okay.
Well, my first question is that how do you explain the collapse of the Soviet Union? And the other is how do you explain that, before 1991, people that were living in the so-called communist country, the Eastern Europe, Soviet Union, Cuba, why people wanted to leave those countries? And in fact, their government prevented them from leaving, and not the opposite. I don't think we didn't see a U.S. citizen trying to escape to Cuba, or people of West Germany wanted to escape in Eastern Germany. So how do
wait. Felons in America aren't allowed to leave the country. Felons?
Criminals.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, criminals aren't allowed to leave. And they criminalized a lot of people and put that on for a lot, like millions of people in the U.S.
Oh, look, I agree that, people that had marijuana pot on them, it's totally stupid. Yeah, most people that are in jail in the U.S. shouldn't be. And a lot of people that are not in jail should be in jail. And I talk about most of the politicians and the billionaire class. I think we agree on that.
At least a few, yeah.
Billy Bob, do you think most people should be in jail?
Not most people that...
No, the U.S. has our society is so devastated. It's just a broken system. Mass incarceration is a broken system. The rampant lack of hope, lack of opportunity within every major city. So I mean, our society has so many problems, but it all stems from the same thing. It stems from a wealthy elite not giving a fuck about anything except their profits. And that's the bottom line. But I mean, Manuel, so those are two good questions and I have long extensive answers, but I don't want to put Tim to sleep and I'm not sure.
Try.
He wanted to be sidetracked. I could try and do it really succinctly. I mean, I can try. So I don't think the Soviet Union collapsed. It was dismantled with an internal coup. They did a vote. The majority of the Soviet people wanted to maintain the union. When they did a vote. So there was actual a vote and they said maintain the union, but it was dismantled as an internal coup by Gorbachev. And that's why you get this term Red-Brown Alliance. So if you've heard of the Red-Brown Alliance, it was the nationalists and the communists opposing Gorbachev of dismantling the Soviet Union. And so that's the origins of the Red-Brown Alliance. But so it wasn't by necessity. It wasn't economically necessary. It didn't collapse. It was an internal coup. And actually, the economy collapsed. After the coup, the economy collapsed. It took them decades to get back up to where they had been as far as GDP goes. If you realize that the United States accounted for half the global economy after World War II, 50% of the global economy, 5% of the population, whereas the Soviet Union had 25, 30 million deaths. It was totally destroyed and devastated by the Nazi invasion. You know, they were poor, impoverished, and they were locked out of accessing, the Western, economy. And, Stalin died in 1953. And then Khrushchev, I don't think, did a very good job. I think if Khrushchev didn't cause the Sino-Soviet split, you would have had a different history. You would have had, China and the USSR could have developed by themselves and probably things would be a lot different. But I blame Khrushchev for the Sino-Soviet split. That was devastating. And so, just the poverty, they couldn't compete. And so with a few people. So there was some people that were very enthralled with liberalism. They wanted peace and they believed all the lies the West was telling them, right? So it was war. There was a Cold War and that Cold War was propaganda, but it was also sabotage. It was industrial sabotage. It was assassinations. There was all kinds of things going on in the Cold War, but there definitely was a certain part of the people in the Soviet Union that wanted what the West was showing them they really wanted. And they were falling for the lies a little, like Gorbachev did. Gorbachev was naive and he fell for the lie. And we know now what's going on, because what happened? Was it peace and mutual prosperity? No, NATO walked right up to Russia's borders, and now we have 500,000 Ukrainians dead. So it was a lie. It was always a lie. The West, the oligarchs, are not interested in peace through mutual prosperity. They're interested in control, controlling the resources, controlling the political apparatus, and controlling the media. And then they're going to, you know, they're going to run things. And you know, humanity is not going to put up with it, guys. Humanity is not going to put up with it. There's resistance, and the West, they're not smart enough to maintain their empire, and it's on its way down, thankfully. But that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Do you know that there are at least two people that I know that predicted what we call the fall or the collapse of the Soviet Union? One of them was Ludwig von Mises, I think, in the 1920s. Ludwig von Mises was a libertarian economist. So he was a hardcore anti-communist. He predicted that the Soviet Union would collapse in the 1920s. You're probably not really interested by that. But there's a second person I know who predicted the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1938. Do you know who it is?
Ooh. Lenin.
No. it's in French. It's the betrayed revolution. So it's Leon Trotsky.
Leon Trotsky. It's like a personal thing there.
Leon Trotsky said in the late 30s that the Soviet Union had two possibilities. There needs to be an international revolution in the advanced capitalist country that will help the Soviet Union to complete its revolution, or the Stalinist bureaucracy will one day restore capitalism and becomes the new bourgeoisie class.
I mean, that's what happened. Again, Stalin died in 53 and the Soviet Union lasted another 30 years. But I do blame the misleadership of the people that followed Stalin. I mean, especially Khrushchev, for mishandling Stalin's death and all that stuff.
And I'm just going to put this out there. I predict the collapse of everything eventually. And
well,
beat death
that was
of
my
the universe.
That was my next point. If you read the Financial Times, like every year for the last 30 years, they've guaranteed that China's economy is going to collapse. So, I mean, it's like this is propaganda. Now, I'm not saying
here's a good point you can score against libertarians. We're always predicting financial and economic calamity, and it always seems to be a couple years away.
You guys see libertarians I'm not familiar with. Are you? Would you say China is capitalist or communist?
Oh, I'd say today I would say it's kind of neither. It's Ludwig von Mises. Ludwig von Mises in the 1930s explained that there were two kinds of socialism. He said there is the Russian socialism, that is communism, where the states own everything, and there is the German socialism, that is fascism. It's where you can own private property, but it's conditional. The state is telling you what to do. We live in a form of fascism. We have fascism in Canada, in the US, in Europe, and in China it's another form. You can own private property in China, but you cannot. It's not a pure private property that you can do whatever you want with it. There's always
China, you have to have 40-year leases. It's 40-year leases with the state.
Yeah, I was thinking it was a 99-year lease on land, but you might be right. It might be 40.
Also, there was a, I think this is from the Mises Institute. They put out a paper talking about the economic freedom in a country as correlated to how crooked its roads are, right? And so they pointed to the fact that because China has these super straight, massive roads, they have their property rights aren't all that strong because the state can just expropriate and plow a road over for the greater good, no matter what they do. But countries that actually have really strong property rights, you actually have to build that shit around people's property, and the roads aren't as straight as one might
like. Interesting. I have never heard that.
My native Pennsylvania.
There you go.
Is it crooked or straight there in Pennsylvania?
Very crooked in Pennsylvania.
Oh, I have a question for Chris. Are you more on the side of Stalin or Trotsky?
Stalin for sure.
Okay. Thank you.
You think I would invite a Trotskyite to have my back?
if you invite libertarians, why not inviting a Trotskyite?
That's a whole interesting debate, and I mean, it's an interesting discussion. I don't have high feelings about Trotsky, but I know most self-identified communists in the United States are Trotskyites. So that's one of the weird things. And I think that has to do with the Cold War and the way the propaganda was flooded into people's, heads. That's condescending.
Yeah, anarcho-communists are just like Trotskyists, and they follow along a similar kind of line of thought.
Before we go on here, guys, I've got a limited amount of time here, but what really interests me about these conversations isn't so much, although it's interesting to talk about all the details you guys are talking about and exploring history and that sort of thing. I'm interested, I think in the kernel of why Billy Bob reached out to me in the first place, which is, let's see if we can have a productive conversation about this. I think we're succeeding here. We're getting somewhere. I feel like we understand each other better. If to have a part two of this, where would you guys like to see us go from there?
Well, I think it was interesting that, I agree that, a working class dictatorship could, be the kind of society that you envision as a libertarian. I don't think that's mutual. They're not mutually exclusive. The material conditions for that to be the best, possible kind of system for the workers would have to exist. And that's where I struggle under, seeing that those conditions existing. But on principle, I do not oppose. And that's kind of what, end stage communism is. It's kind of like, the state has been abolished. We don't have borders. We don't have owners. It's, the workers own the means of production. It's cashless. We don't even do money. It's a state of what's that word, Chris? Where there's no longer any scarcity. So we've abolished scarcity. There's material abundance. So I mean, given that kind of material conditions, without wars, without things like that, a libertarian style society is totally compatible with communism. But the issue is, what are the material conditions and what constraints do those material conditions give to us who are trying to make things better? Like, we're just about improvement.
And what do you mean by material conditions?
Well, it's just what I'm saying. Like, material conditions are like everything that exists. So the like mass the consciousness, the context, all the issues.
Yeah, context, I guess, would be like a good synonym. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah, because when you say material conditions, I think of whether that someone's poor or how much material they have or something like that. So that's just why I wanted to clarify that. But what you mean is like the environment, the context, the zeitgeist,
the underlying culture.
Gotcha.
Okay. But where it comes together is production and industry.
If there is a revolution, and let's say the wealth of the illegitimate wealth of the billionaire is expropriated and redistributed, which I would not oppose to, let's be clear. If you guys succeed in doing that, because the majority of the people goes for it, I have no problem as long as they would let me and Tim alone. Our house and our small business that we didn't create it with violence.
And even if I want to hire Manuel to do yard work and pay him scraps from my table, as long as he agrees to it, you leave us the hell alone.
Yeah. That, I wouldn't. I wouldn't do that for Scrum.
You know, it occurs to me that I mean, libertarians often kind of envision a future where production is kind of democratized anyways, right? I mean, we look at things like 3D printers, nanobots, AI. A lot of people look at that and say, oh, it's going to take my job. I look at it and say, hey, I can fucking become my own employer. I can employ this robot to make whatever the hell I want. I don't have to work for the man anymore. That's awesome. I can choose to do something different. But that sounds like we end up in something in a world that you guys might not hate either, right? Is one where everyone essentially owns the means of production. I can cooperate and pool my resources with someone else if I want, or I can just go my own way. I don't think you guys would have any problem with that, right? You wouldn't come and shoot me or throw me in a ditch or throw me in a gulag.
Communism is inevitable.
Okay.
So well, all 3D printers, Bob, material abundance, post scarcity.
I think Billy Bob and Chris will agree with us that intellectual property is wrong. It's legitimate.
Yeah, intellectual property, like
it's stupid, but
you get a name after it. Like Kalashnikov is one of my favorites, but I don't got to pay his family, you know.
Because intellectual property is a kind of cartel, and it limits, it's a stop to productivity. It limits productivity to enrich people by creating scarcity, but it can only exist with a state.
Just look at movies right now. Like I was trying to watch Clerks. That's my favorite movie like ever, and I couldn't find it on Netflix. I couldn't find it on YouTube Premium or nothing. So like now I have to go through all these archives. Like what happened to Pirate Bay and all that stuff? You know, like
supposed the to government, be more that's liberated. Got to get rid of it.
Isn't was it Pirate Bay that guy from New Zealand? What's his name?
Kim.com.
Kim.com.
Yeah.
He's been under a lot of attack from the bourgeois government. So we make a distinction between
the bourgeois government. Yeah, exactly.
The bad government, not the good government, not the good gang of criminals, the bad gang of criminals.
Like Lenin said, it's either going to be a vehicle of repression for the bourgeoisie or for the workers. Now, do you think, Tim, that there's can you conceptualize the state as a tool that can do good things for society? Or is it just all bad in your mind? Like, I mean, like an axe can take down a tree if it's handled by a good person, but then it can be used to murder your wife if you're, a bad person.
Yeah, no, I get you. But the state by definition, by a libertarian definition, at least the type of a libertarian that me and Manuel are, is a violent cartel. It's defined by it's evil, right? I mean, that's what makes it special. It can do things that you and I can't do. It has rights that you and I don't have. My brand of libertarianism is an attitudinal disposition of skepticism towards that moral claim that those individuals that we call the state can do things like force their will on me without my consent. And I don't have that right to do it. You know, if I were to set up, let's say, I don't know, public housing or public health, while I'd be imprisoned for violent extortion because I'd have to rob all my neighbors and force them at gunpoint to give me money to fund my endeavor. I'd be thrown in jail for intimidating doctors and nurses because they'd be under my control and I'd be telling them what to do. They'd have to follow my policy to provide this public good. And so but government, on the other hand, if they do it, they're looked at as angels. But they look at me as a felon when I do it, and rightfully so, because that's a violation of that crosses the line of justice.
Tim, man,
it's the line between good and evil, right?
I gotta say something about that. I'm like, I see you're a fireman and everything, but like, there was a fire in my neighborhood not too long ago, right? And this is a good example of what you're saying. There is a fire in a boarding house where they usually keep like, I don't know, 10, 20 students in a pretty small place. And two people died in that boarding house. But the government, like, the city government came through and, like, inspected everywhere that was a boarding house. and they closed a whole bunch of them down, saying that they don't follow the permits.
Yeah.
So, like, instead of the government fixing those sorts of things, they just fine the landowners.
Sorry, is that a question or?
Well, like, what do you think, like, a state, if it was going to act correctly, would, like, fix the fire hazards, or would it?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, the state, I'm sure the state accidentally does some good things, right? Like, I mean, criminal gangs, MI-13, when it's not beheading people, might do some charity work that I agree is good. But I still wouldn't argue that MI-13 is the best way to provide that charity work, and that it's good to have it. There's probably better ways of having it. And, you know, I'd like to think that charity work could get done even if a criminal gang that was beheading people didn't do it. And so, you know, one of my long-term projects is to write a book about firefighting, because there is a lot of nuance to unpack here. Like, how would firefighting work without a state? I mean, we have historical examples, some good, some bad. We could imagine how things could work. And, you know, I would imagine that people that live in a community would want fire protection. I'd imagine that, if I developed some land and sold some lots to people and they'd only want to buy those lots and live in that community whose infrastructure I created. If I created a set of rules that was probably somewhat egalitarian, provided top level service, that there would be reciprocity and immediate access to justice if I didn't live up to my end of the bargain. And so that if my fire response times weren't on point, what I get, you know, guaranteed pizza delivery in under 30 minutes or it's free. But, you know, if the fire department is late or doesn't do a good job, what recourse do you have? Who, you know? So, yes, I think there's all sorts of ways we could predict that a private property order could deal with these things. In fact, I saw a little bit of that when I was in Africa years ago in Tanzania. They had a very kind of, it reminded me of the Wild West a little bit. They had just had some kind of, I don't know what you would call them, liberal reforms that allowed people to enter marketplaces. And so the economy was bustling, but there was no institutional interstitium there at all. Like, it was just people trying to solve problems. Interstitium. Like, there was no government institutions holding communities together. Like, there was no fire departments or, it was just basically, there was a demand and these entrepreneurs would rise up and try to figure out how they can meet the demand. So, for example, I was seeing fire departments and companies start that were fire security EMS, right? So basically what we would think of as police, ambulance, fire here in North America. And these people were competing on the open market against other similar services. You know, I thought it would be interesting to go over there with my knowledge and expertise and maybe start a competing enterprise. I'd train firefighters, I'd hire them. We would do things like it's a good thought experiment. If I was running a fire department in a free market system, what would it look like? There's some historical examples, like one of the largest fire departments in EMS companies in America was started by a guy, it's Rural Metro, and it was started by a guy in the 40s. His neighbor's house burnt down. He realized there was a demand. So he went out, took it on himself, bought a fire truck, you know, went around to his neighbor, said, hey, if you chip in and pay me a subscription fee, I'll guarantee you a response time or whatever. If you don't chip in, no big deal, but just, and I'll still put out your house, but just know that I'll send you a big bill at the end if that's what you want, right? If you allow me to put out your house. And so most of his neighbors chipped in and he's kind of started a subscription model that grew from there. Now, of course, because we're in a statist environment, you would call it maybe capitalist. I would call it statist. There's all sorts of opportunity. And the people who make the best businessmen in this environment are the ones who cozy up to the state and get monopoly privileges and power. And so, you know, that always ends up getting corrupted in a statist environment. But over in Tanzania, the state didn't have that much power yet. It was just a poor country emerging into this huge bubbling, dynamic, chaotic, creative force of its citizens all of a sudden getting all this freedom and ability, right? And so so what I would imagine doing over there is going to businesses and saying, look, we'll basically operate as an insurance company, and we'll guarantee a response time and different things like that. And we'll charge you a much lower rate if you voluntarily submit yourself to random fire inspections. Here's a set of fire codes. If you subscribe to these and closely align with them, you'll have a very low insurance rate. And by the way, you'll have the peace of mind knowing that your business is as safe as can be from fire. And so I would imagine most people would sign on to that. But if you don't, you know, we can bill you after the fact, and you could just kind of roll the dice. It's up to you. We'll leave it up to you. So I mean, you can imagine all
that's
sorts of ways.
Awesome, man. I like what you're saying there. Fire insurance partnership, man. And it makes everybody safer,
right?
But it's a good business model.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah, and it's an interesting thought experiment as a guy who works for the public sector, right, where things are the way they are largely because of political forces, politicians trying to win popularity contests and different things like that, rather than maybe meeting a specific customer need. I'm a vice president of a union now, and we play a large hand in politics, and we want to get our needs met.
You're the vice president of a union. You're
just while I actually
get the libertarian president guy.
maybe I get sworn in on Monday, but here again, Chris, it's, I look at it as, first of all, we have no problem with collective bargaining at all. It's just that for some reason, collective bargaining seems to be thought of as a leftist idea. And also, just like corporations and businesses like Rural Metro, unions also get corrupted because they go to the state to bend laws in their favor to make sure they have a monopoly on bargaining power and different things like that. And so that corrupts the whole enterprise over time. And so, yes, there's corruption in all these areas because of the state. And my job is to try to remain as principled as I can in that position. And there's some things I want to fight for that will benefit our membership, that will benefit our community, that will benefit our province, that line up with my principles. And right now is a good time. And that has to do with decentralizing emergency medical services provincially. Right now it's under one giant kind of central bureaucracy that is failing everyone. And I think I can make a strong push within a union to decentralize that. And I think that would be good for everyone. And it certainly wouldn't fly in the face of my principles at all. In fact, it promotes them.
Me, I'm very pro-union. I was under a lockout for 6 months in 2022, and I really appreciated to be in a union. And I think in a free market, union are absolutely compatible, and I would even say necessary, because as a way to equilibrate thing and share the wealth in a sense.
Well, they're often mutually beneficial too, because, yeah. I talked to a guy who runs it's an oil field service company, and he says he prefers to have a union shop because it makes it easier to negotiate wage and keep everyone happy and keep everything fair. It's less stress, to then individually negotiating contracts and trying to keep track of things and having one staff figure it out, the other person's getting more benefits. He says, I don't want that headache. I would rather pay a premium to have a union shop in there and not have to worry about the headache of contracting out to every single individual.
That's awesome, man. Like, I never thought of having that good of a sales pitch. I mean, like, why then the HR in my company right now is just so like all over the place and shit. Like, yeah, if we were just a union shop, like, you'd be very simple to like keep track of.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you can make a pitch to them that this will make your job easier. It'll save you a lot of money. I mean, I'm sure HR, the HR departments can grow the more turmoil there is in your in your organization. So you might want to go around the HR department to whoever is in charge of the HR department and say, look, I know the HR department wants a bunch of animosity and bad feelings because it creates more jobs for them. But don't you think we'd be better if there was less animosity and fighting and everyone, you know, less internal politicking and backstabbing and blah, 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 and just get everyone on the same page. So, yeah.
The world's greatest, largest, most effective trade union is obviously the one in China.
The what? Sorry?
The one in China. The trade, union, the workers' union in China is the largest union in the universe, and it's been the most effective. You know, wages in China have tripled every 10 years for like 30 years in a row. You know, job conditions have improved dramatically.
Right.
So we all like unions. Look, there's a lot of agreement here. And that's the thing. Like, I don't think that there's this big chasm between people that identify as libertarian and people that identify as communist. I think there are differences, but there's not anything we can't overcome. And I think it's kind of more of a conceptual thing. Like, how do we look at reality and what are the fundamental steps we need to take to improve it? I think that's where the confusion lies, and that's where there's maybe some disagreement. But I think we both want the same thing. Like, we're sick of the oligarchy, and we want to improve on that. Amen. But I appreciate it, Tim. This is really magnanimous of you to have us.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
No, I'm happy to do it, and you know, I'm sorry it took this long to get it going. I wanted to treat this conversation with appropriate preparation and seriousness. You know, I didn't want to just kind of, but at the end of the day, we kind of did have to go off the cuff because it's like, I can't keep putting this off waiting for the perfect time. I can't let perfection become the enemy of the good. Let's just do it. I know I have some time here and let's see what happens. And I'm glad I did. You know, I can't keep being such a perfectionist about things, you know. So it was a good conversation at the end of the day. So I appreciate you guys all hopping in. Any last words, guys, or Manuel?
No, I'm glad I'm glad we had this chat. If ever Billy Bob wants to invite me to a conversation with his friends, especially if they talk about war and imperialism, I would be glad to.
All right. Bring
things.
Yeah.
No, that sounds good, Manuel. I'll send you an invite because we do a twice weekly program. So.
Yeah, I would like to chat with the guy that looks like Karl Marx. There's a guy in his group that I listened to a few of his talk. There's a guy that exactly looked like Karl Marx.
Is that right, eh? And Chris, it's got to be about, 4:30 a.m. there in the Philippines?
Yeah, it's 5 now, yeah.
5? What does a guy like you do at this time of the morning? Is this your bedtime now, or are you up for the day?
I'm going to be up for the day. I'm going to be riding some ATVs later. So I'm just going to be drinking some coffee. And
I was going to say, are you getting up to rise and grind? But no, you're going out to have some leisure fun.
Oh yeah. I'm actually doing a huge garden project because my lot over here, it's just overrun with stuff. So I'm taking two ATVs and ATV quads and just ripping the crap out of it. So I can't wait. Nice.
Love it. Farming. Billy Bob.
I have like a 4-week vacation. I have another week left to go. I actually got to go back for one day on Monday and then I'm off again until Saturday. So I'm enjoying life. I just was in Mexico. So I have some color, which is nice. But Chris is definitely, he pulled an all nighter. I don't know how he's going to do farming after not even sleeping. Like that's my worst nightmare. I need some rest, but, that was nice of him.
You can't even get any stimulants down there, can you? Because of your
old
Duarte or whatever his name is there. He wasn't a big fan of the stimulants, was he?
I mean, meth is like gone, but the market out here is loose.
Gotcha. Okay, well, Duarte, turn away. Hopefully he's not listening to this podcast.
Duterte's gone.
Oh, he's gone. Is the new guy better?
No, he's not better. And he's doing trades with the U.S. and Defense Department and stuff instead of being neutral. I don't know. And I could go into that for a while.
Yeah, I bet. All right, guys, Yeah, I'd love to pick this up again sometime. Maybe we can think a little bit about where do we go from here in this conversation? What would we want to get out of it? The main thing I'm getting, you know, I didn't go into this expecting anyone's mind to be changed, but I was just hoping to have more productive conversations. I think what's missing in today's political landscape is respectful, good faith conversations. And I think we accomplished that today. So congratulations to all of you. And thank you for joining me on the Tim Moen Show. Everyone out there, tell us what you thought. Do you want to see more of this? Do you want to see something else? Make sure you hit like and subscribe. Just smash that button. Just chest bump it, whatever. We'll see you next time. Yeah.
I have a suggestion for you. You like to interview people that think differently. Would you be interested to interview a former libertarian that became a Nazi?
Oh, absolutely. Oh my God. Let's do it.
Because
we're talking to commies. How bad can Nazis be, right?
You guys better bring a rope or something, Jeez. Man. Make that fucker work.
You know what? Actually, one of the things I was thinking about doing is I like this idea of steel manning, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think what I'd like to do is have a steel man episode every now and then, make it kind of a running thing where I have people that I wildly disagree with and try to argue their point for them better than they can argue it themselves and vice versa. Because I do like that idea. I think that's a good way of finding common ground and like really exploring ideas. So, all right. Yeah. Once again, guys, thank you very much. Watch for a steel man debate of me and Manuel versus a Nazi, I guess, where we will be taking the side of Nazism. What? All right. Don't spike me, YouTube.
Thanks, Tim.